canvas. When I turn back, the man is in my face, his breath rank with alcohol. "We don't got no room for bums on this train, brother. He can get right back off."
"Now hold on, Blackie," says the old man with the jug. "Don't go doing nothing rash now, you hear?"
"Rash nothing," says Blackie, reaching for my collar. I swat his arm away. He reaches with his other hand, and I swing up to stop him. The bones in our forearms meet with a crack.
"Woohoo!"
cackles the old man.
"Watch yourself, pal. Don't go messing with Blackie."
"It seems to me maybe Blackie's messing with me," I shout, blocking another blow. Blackie lunges. I fall onto a roll of canvas, and before my head even hits, I'm yanked forward again. A moment later, my right arm is twisted behind my back, and my feet hang over the edge of the open door, and I'm facing a line of trees that passes altogether too quickly.
"Blackie,"
barks the old guy.
"Blackie, let him go. Let him go, I tell you, and on the inside of the train, too."
Blackie yanks my arm up toward the nape of my neck and shakes me.
"Blackie, I'm telling you," shouts the old man, "we don't need no trouble. Let him go."
Blackie dangles me a little further out the door, then pivots and tosses me across the rolls of canvas. He returns to the other men, snatches the earthenware jug, and then passes right by me, climbing over the canvas and retreating to the far corner of the car. I watch him closely, rubbing my wrenched arm.
"Don't be sore, kid," says the old man. "Throwing people off of trains is one of the perks of Blackie's job, and he ain't got to do it in a while. Here," he says, patting the floor with the flat of his hand. "Come on over here."
I shoot another glance at Blackie.
"Come on now," says the old man. "Don't be shy. Blackie's gonna behave now. Ain't you, Blackie?"
Blackie grunts and takes a swig. I rise and move cautiously toward the others. The old man sticks his right hand up at me. I hesitate and then take it.
"I'm Camel," he says. "And it's here's Grady. That's Bill. I believe you've already made Blackie's acquaintance."
He smiles, revealing a scant handful of teeth. "How do you do?" I say.
"Grady, get that jug back, will you?" says Camel.
Grady trains his gaze on me, and I meet it. After a while, he gets up and moves silently toward Blackie. Camel struggles to his feet, so stiff that at one point I reach out and steady his elbow. Once he's upright, he holds the kerosene lamp out and squints into my face. He peers at my clothes, surveying me from top to bottom.
"Now, what did I tell you, Blackie?" he calls out crossly. "This here ain't no bum. Blackie, get on over here and take a look. Learn yourself the difference."
Blackie grunts, takes one last swallow, and relinquishes the jug to Grady. Camel squints up at me.
"What'd you say your name was?"
"Jacob Jankowski."
"You got red hair."
So I've heard."
"Where are you from?"
I pause. "Am I from Norwich or Ithaca? Is where you're from the place you're leaving or where you have roots?" "Nowhere," I say. Camel's face hardens. He weaves slightly on bowed legs, casting an uneven light from the swinging lantern.
"You done something, boy. You on the lam."
"No," I say, "nothing like that." He squints at me a while longer and then nods.
"All right, then. None of my business, nohow. Where are you headed?"
"Not sure."
"You out of work?"
"Yes, sir, I reckon I am."
"Ain't no shame in it," he says. "What can you do?"
"About anything," I say. Grady appears with the jug and hands it to Camel. He wipes its neck with his sleeve and passes it to me.
"Here, have a belt."
Now, I'm no virgin to liquor, but moonshine is another beast entirely.
Oh, it burns hellfire through my chest and head. I catch my breath and fight back tears, staring Camel straight in the eyes, even as my lungs threaten to combust.
Camel observes and nods slowly.
We'll land in Utica in the morning. I'll take you to see Uncle Al.
Who? What?
You know, Alan Bunkle. Ringmaster extraordinaire, lord and master of the known and unknown universes.
I must look baffled because Camel lets loose with a toothless cackle.
Kid, don't tell me you didn't notice.
Notice what, I ask.
Shit, boys,
he hoots, looking around at the others.
He really don't know.
Grady and Bill smirk. Only Blackie is unamused. He scowls, pulling his hat farther down his face. Camel turns toward me, clears his throat, and speaks slowly, savoring each word.
You didn't just jump a train, boy. You done jumped the flying squadron of the Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on Earth.
The what? I say. Camel laughs so hard he doubles over.
Oh, that's precious, precious indeed, he says, sniffing and wiping his eyes with the back of his hand. Oh, me, you done landed your ass on a circus, boy.
I blink at him.
That there's the big top,
he says, lifting the kerosene lamp and waving a crooked finger at the great rolls of canvas.
One of the canvas wagons caught the runs wrong and busted up real good. So here it is. Might as well find a place to sleep. It's gonna be a few hours before we land. Just don't lie too close to the door, that's all. Sometimes we take them corners awful sharp.
Chapter 3.
I awake to the prolonged screeching of brakes. I'm wedged a good deal farther between the rolls of canvas than I was when I fell asleep, and I'm disoriented. It takes me a second to figure out where I am. The train shudders to a stop and exhales. Blackie, Bill, and Grady roll to their feet and drop wordlessly out the door. After they're gone, Camel hobbles over. He leans down and pokes me.
Come on, kid, he says. You gotta get out of here before the canvas men arrive. I'm gonna try to set you up with Crazy Joe this morning.
Crazy Joe, I say, sitting up. My shins are itchy and my neck hurts like a son of a bitch.
Head horse honcho, says Camel. Of baggage stock, that is. August don't let him nowhere near the ring stock. Actually, it's probably Marlena that don't let him near. But it don't make no difference. She won't let you nowhere near neither. With Crazy Joe, at least you got a shot. We had a run of bad weather and muddy lots, and a bunch of his men got tired of working Chinese and moped off. Left him a bit short.
Why is he called Crazy Joe?
Don't rightly know, says Camel.
He digs inside his ear and inspects his findings.
Think he was in the big house for a while, but I don't know why. Wouldn't suggest you ask, neither.
He wipes his finger on his pants and ambles to the doorway.
Well, come on then,
he says, looking back at me.
We don't got all day.
He eases himself onto the edge and slides carefully to the gravel. I give my shins one last desperate scratch, tie my shoes, and follow. We are adjacent to a huge grassy lot. Beyond it are scattered brick buildings backlit by the pre-dawn glow. Hundreds of dirty, unshaven men pour from the train and surround it like ants on candy, cursing and stretching and lighting cigarettes. Ramps and chutes clatter to the ground, and 6 and 8 horse hitches materialize from nowhere, spread out on the dirt. Horse after horse appears, heavy bob-tailed percherons that clomp down the ramps, snorting and blowing and already in harness. Men on either side hold the swinging doors close to the sides of the ramps, keeping the animals from getting too close to the edge. A group of men marches toward us, heads down. "Morning, camel," says the leader as he passes us and climbs into the car. The others clamber up behind him. They surround a bundle of canvas and heave it toward the entrance, grunting with effort. It moves about a foot and a half and lands in a cloud of dust.
"Morning, Will," says Camel. "Say, got a smoke for an old man?"
"Sure." The man straightens up and pats his shirt pockets. He digs into one and retrieves a bent cigarette. "It's Bull Durham," he says, leaning forward and holding it out. "Sorry."
"Roll your own suits me fine," says Camel. "Thanks, Will. Much obliged."
Will jerks his thumb at me. "Who's that?"
"A First of May. Name's Jacob Jankowski."
Will looks at me, and then turns and spits out the door. "How new?" he says, continuing to address Camel.
"Real new."
"You got him on yet?"
"Nope."
"Well, good luck to you," he tips his hat at me. "Don't sleep too sound, kid, if you know what I mean." He disappears into the interior. "What does that mean?" I say, but Camel is walking away. I jog a little to catch up. There are now hundreds of horses among the dirty men. At first glance, the scene looks chaotic, but by the time Camel has lit a cigarette, several dozen teams are hitched and moving alongside the flat cars, pulling wagons toward the runs. As soon as a wagon's front wheels hit the sloped wooden tracks, the man guiding its pole leaps out of the way. And it's a good thing, too. The heavily loaded wagons come barreling down the runs and don't stop until they're a dozen feet away. In the morning light, I see what I couldn't last night. The wagons are painted scarlet with gold trim and sunburst wheels, each emblazoned with the name Benzini Brothers' Most Spectacular Show on Earth. As soon as the wagons are hitched to teams, the Percherons lean into their harnesses and drag their heavy loads across the field.
"Watch out!"
says Camel, grabbing my arm and pulling me toward him. He braces his hat with his other hand, the lumpy cigarette clenched in his teeth. Three men on horseback gallop past. They swerve and cross the length of the field, tour its perimeter, and then swing back around. The one in the lead turns his head from side to side, shrewdly assessing the ground. He holds both reins in one hand, and with the other retrieves flagged darts from a leather pouch, flinging them into the earth. "What's he doing?" I ask.
"Laying out the lot," says Camel.
He comes to a stop in front of a stock car.
"Joe! Hey, Joe!"
A head appears in the doorway.
"I got a First of May here, fresh from the crate. Think you can use them?"
A figure steps forward onto the ramp. He pushes up the brim of a battered hat with a hand missing three of its fingers. He scrutinizes me, shoots an oyster of dark brown tobacco juice out the side of his mouth, and goes back inside. Camel pats my arm in a congratulatory fashion.
"You're in, kid."
"I am."
"Yep. Now, go shovel some shit. I'll catch up with you later."
The stock car is an ungodly mess. I work with a kid named Charlie whose face is smooth as a girl's. His voice hasn't even broken yet. After we shovel what seems like a cubic ton of manure out the door, I pause, surveying the remaining mess. "How many horses do they load in here anyway?"
27.
"Jesus, they must be packed in here so tight they can't move."
"That's the idea,"
Charlie says.
"Once the wedge horse loads, none of them can go down."
The exposed tails from last night suddenly make sense. Joe appears in the doorway. "Flags up," he growls. Charlie drops his shovel and heads for the door. "What's going on? Where are we going?" I say.
"The cookhouse flags up."
I shake my head. "I'm sorry, I still don't understand."
"Chow,"
he says. "Now that I understand." I, too, drop my shovel. Canvas tents have popped up like mushrooms, although the largest one,
obviously the big top, still lies flat on the ground. Men stand over its seams, bending at the waist and lacing its pieces together. Towering wooden poles stick up through its center line, already flying Old Glory. With the rigging on the poles, it looks like the deck and mast of a sailboat. All around its perimeter, 8-man sledge teams pound in stakes at breakneck speed. By the time one sledge hits the stake, 5 others are in motion. The resulting noise is as regular as machine gun fire, cutting through the rest of the din. Teams of men are also raising enormous poles. Charlie and I pass a group of 10 throwing their combined weight against a single rope as a man off to the side chants,
"Pull it! Shake it! Break it! Again! Pull it! Shake it! Break it! Now! Downstake it!"
The cookhouse couldn't be more obvious. Never mind the orange and blue flag, the boiler belching in the background, or the stream of people heading for it. The smell of food hits me like a cannonball in the gut. I haven't eaten since the day before yesterday, and my stomach twists with hunger. The sidewalls of the cookhouse have been raised to allow for a draft, but it is divided down the center by a curtain. The tables on this side are graced with red and white checked tablecloths, silverware, and vases of flowers. This seems wildly out of sync with the line of filthy men snaking behind the steam tables. "My God," I say to Charlie as we take our place in line, "look at this spread. There are hash browns, sausages, and heaping baskets of thickly sliced bread, spiral-cut ham, eggs cooked every which way, jam in pots, bowls of oranges."
"Oh, this ain't nothing," he says. "Big Bertha's got all this, and waiters, too. You just sit at your table and they bring it right to you."
"Big Bertha?"
"Ringling," he says.
"You work for them?"
No, he says sheepishly. "But I know people who have."
I grab a plate and scoop up a mountain of potatoes, eggs, and sausages, trying to keep from looking desperate. The scent is overwhelming. I open my mouth, inhaling deeply. It's like manna from heaven. It is manna from heaven. Camel appears from nowhere.
"Here! Give this here to that fella there at the end of the line,"
he says, pressing a ticket into my free hand. The man at the end of the line sits in a folding chair, looking out from under the brim of a bent fedora. I hold out the ticket. He looks up at me, arms crossed firmly in front of him. "Department," he says. "I beg your pardon," I say. "What's your department?" I'm not sure," I say. "I've been mucking out stock cars all morning."
"That don't tell me nothing," he says, continuing to ignore my ticket. "That could be ring stock, baggage stock, or menagerie, so which is it?"
I don't answer. I'm pretty sure Camel mentioned at least a couple of those, but I don't remember the specifics.
"If you don't know your department, you ain't on the show," the man says. "So who the hell are you?"
"Everything okay, Ezra?"
says Camel, coming up behind me.
"No, it ain't. I got me some smart-ass rube trying to filch breakfast from the show," says Ezra, spitting on the ground.
"He ain't no rube," says Camel. "He's a First of May, and he's with me."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah."
The man flicks the brim of his hat up and checks me out, head to toe. He pauses a few beats longer and then says,
"All right, Camel. If you're vouching for him, I reckon that's good enough for me."
The hand comes out, snatches my ticket. "Something else. Teach him how to talk before he gets the shit kicked out of him, will you?"
"So what's my department?" I ask, heading for a table.
"Oh, no you don't," says Camel, grabbing my elbow. "Them tables ain't for the likes of us. You stick close to me till you learn your way around."
I follow him around the curtain. The tables in the other half are set end to end, their bare wood graced only with salt and pepper shakers. No flowers here. "Who sits on the other side, performers?" Camel shoots me a look.
"Good God, kid, just keep your trap shut till you learn the vernacular, would you?"
He sits down and immediately shoves a half a piece of bread into his mouth. He chews on it for a minute and then looks across at me.
Oh, go on, don't be sore. I'm just looking out for you. You saw how Ezra was, and Ezra's a pussycat. Sit yourself down.
I look at him for a moment longer and then step over the bench. I set my plate down, glance at my manure-stained hands, wipe them on my pants, and, finding them no cleaner, dig into my food anyway. So, what's the vernacular, then? I say finally.
They're called kinkers,
says Camel, talking around a mouthful of chewed food.
And your department is baggage stock for now.
So where are these kinkers?
They'll be pulling in any time. There's two more sections of train still to come. They stay up late, sleep late, and arrive just in time for breakfast. And while we're on the subject, don't you go calling them kinkers to their faces, neither.
What do I call them?
Performers.
So why can't I just call them performers all the time? I say with a note of irritation creeping into my voice.
There's them, and there's us, and you're us, says Camel. Never mind, you'll learn.
A train whistles in the distance.
Speak of the devil.
Is Uncle Al with them?
Yep, but don't you go getting any ideas. We ain't going near him till later. He's cranky as a bear with a toothache when we're still setting up. Say, how you making out with Joe? Had enough of horse shit yet?
I don't mind.
Yeah, well, I figure you for better than that. I've been talking to a friend of mine,
Camel says, crushing another piece of bread between his fingers and using it to wipe grease from his plate.
You stick with him the rest of the day, and he'll put in a word for you.
What'll I be doing?
Whatever he says. And I mean that, too.
He cocks an eyebrow for emphasis. Camel's friend is a small man with a large paunch and a booming voice. He's the sideshow talker, and his name is Cecil. He examines me and declares me suitable for the job at hand. I, along with Jimmy and Wade, two other men deemed presentable enough to mix with the townsfolk, are supposed to position ourselves around the edges of the crowd and then, when we get the signal, step forward and jostle them toward the entrance. The sideshow is on the midway, which teems with activity. On one side, a group of black men struggles to put up the sideshow banners. On the other, there's clinking and shouting as white-jacketed white men set up glass after glass of lemonade, forming pyramids of full glasses on the counters of their red and white-striped concession stands. The air is filled with the scents of corn popping, peanuts roasting, and the tangy undertone of animal. At the end of the midway, beyond the ticket gate, is a huge tent into which all manner of creatures is being carted. Llamas, camels, zebras, monkeys, at least one polar bear, and cage after cage of cats. Cecil and one of the black men fuss with a banner featuring an enormously fat woman. After a couple of seconds, Cecil slaps the other man's head.
Get with it, boy. We're going to be crawling with suckers in a minute. How are we going to bring them in if they can't see Lucinda's splendors?
A whistle blows and everyone freezes.
Doors!
Booms a male voice.
All hell breaks loose. The men at the concession stand scurry behind the counters, making final adjustments to their wares and straightening their jackets and caps. With the exception of the poor soul still working on Lucinda's banner, all the black men slip through the canvas and out of sight.
Get that goddamn banner up and get out of here, Cecil screams.
The man makes one final adjustment and disappears. I turn. A wall of humans swells toward us, with squealing children leading the way, yanking their parents forward by the hand. Wade jabs an elbow in my side.
Psst. You want to see the menagerie?
The what? He cocks his head at the tent between us and the big top.
You've been craning your neck since you got here. Want to take a peek?
What about him? I say, jerking my eyes towards Cecil.
We'll be back before he misses us. Besides, we can't do nothing till he gets a crowd going.
Wade leads me to the ticket gate. Old men guard it, sitting behind four red podiums. Three ignore us. The fourth glances at Wade and nods.
Go on, have a peek, says Wade. I'll keep an eye on Cecil.
I peer inside. The tent is enormous, as tall as the sky and supported by long, straight poles jutting at various angles. The canvas is taut and nearly translucent. Sunlight filters through the material and seams, illuminating the largest candy stand of all. It's smack in the center of the menagerie, under rays of glorious light, surrounded by banners advertising sarsaparilla, Cracker Jack, and frozen custard. Brilliantly painted red and gold animal dens line two of the four walls, their sides propped open to reveal lions, tigers, panthers, jaguars, bears, chimps, and spider monkeys, even an orangutan. Camels, llamas, zebras, and horses stand behind low ropes slung between iron stakes, their heads buried in mounds of hay. Two giraffes stand within an area enclosed by chain-link fence. I'm searching in vain for an elephant when my eyes come to an abrupt stop on a woman. She looks so much like Catherine, I catch my breath. The plane of her face, the cut of her hair, the slim thighs I've always imagined were under Catherine's staid skirts. She's standing in front of a row of black and white horses, wearing pink sequins, tights, and satin slippers, talking to a man in top hat and tails. She cups the muzzle of one of the white horses, a striking Arabian with a silver mane and tail. She lifts a hand to push back a piece of her light brown hair and adjusts her headdress. Then she reaches up and smooths the horse's forelock against his face. She grasps his ear in her fist, letting it slide through her fingers. There's an enormous crash, and I spin to find that the side of the closest animal den has slammed shut. When I turn back, the woman is looking at me. Her brow furrows as though in recognition. After a few seconds, I realize I should smile or drop my eyes or do something, but I can't. Eventually, the man in the top hat puts his hand on her shoulder and she turns. But slowly, reluctantly, after a few seconds, she steals another glance. Wade is back. Come on, he says, slapping me between the shoulder blades. It's showtime.
Ladies and gentlemen, 25 minutes till the big show. 25 minutes, more than enough time to avail yourselves of the amazing, the unbelievable, the marvelous wonders we have gathered from all four corners of the earth, and still find a good seat in the big top. Plenty of time to see the oddities, the freaks of nature, the spectacles. Ours is the most dazzling collection in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, in the world, I tell you.
Cecil stands on a platform beside the sideshow's entrance. He struts back and forth, gesturing grandly. A crowd of about 50 hovers loosely. They're uncommitted. More paused than stopped.
Step right this way to see the gorgeous, the enormous, the lovely Lucinda, the world's most beautiful fat lady. 885 pounds of pudgy perfection, ladies and gentlemen. Come see the human ostrich. He can swallow and return anything you hand him. Give it a try. Wallets, watches, even light bulbs. You name it, he'll regurgitate it. And don't miss Frank Otto, the world's most tattooed man. Held hostage in the darkest jungles of Borneo and tried for a crime he didn't commit. And his punishment? Well, folks, his punishment is written all over his body in permanent ink.
The crowd is denser, their interest piqued. Jimmy, Wade, and I mingle near the back.
And now, says Cecil, swinging around. He puts his finger to his lips and winks grotesquely,
an exaggerated gesture that pulls the side of his mouth up toward his eye. He raises his hand in the air, asking for quiet.
And now, my apologies, ladies, but this is for the gentlemen only. The gentlemen only. Because we're in mixed company, for delicacy's sake.
I can only say this once. Gentlemen, if you're a red-blooded American, if you've got manly blood flowing through your veins, then this is something you don't want to miss. If you'll follow that there fella, right there, just right over there, you'll see something so amazing, so shocking, it's guaranteed to...
He stops, closes his eyes, and lifts a hand. He shakes his head with remorse.
But no, he continues, in the interest of decency, and on account of being in mixed company, I can't say any more than that. Can't say any more, gentlemen, except this. You don't want to miss it. Just hand your quarter to this fella here and he'll take you right in. You'll never remember the quarter you spent here today, and you'll never forget what you see. You'll be talking about this for the rest of your lives, fellas. The rest of your lives.
Cecil straightens up and adjusts his checked waistcoat, tugging the hem with both hands. His face assumes a deferential expression, and he gestures broadly toward an entrance on the opposite side.
And ladies, if you'll kindly come this way, we have wonders and curiosities suitable for your delicate sensibilities, too. A gentleman would never forget the ladies, especially such lovely ladies as yourselves.
With this, he smiles and closes his eyes. The women in the crowd glance nervously at the disappearing men. A tug of war is broken out. A woman holds fast to her husband's sleeve with one hand and bats him with the other. He grimaces and frowns, ducking to avoid her blows. When he finally breaks free, he straightens his lapels and glowers at his now sulking wife. As he struts off to hand over his quarter, someone clucks like a hen. Laughter ripples through the crowd. The rest of the women, perhaps because they don't want to make a spectacle, watch reluctantly as their men drift off and get in line. Cecil sees this and comes down from his platform. He is all concern, all gallant attention, gently drawing them toward more savory matters. He touches his left earlobe. I push imperceptibly forward. The women move closer to Cecil, and I feel like a sheepdog.
If you'll step this way, Cecil continues, I'll show you ladies something you've never seen before. Something so unusual, so extraordinary, you never dreamed it existed, and yet it's something you can talk about at church this Sunday, or with Grandma and Grandpa at the dinner table. Go ahead and bring the little fellas. This here is strictly family fun. See a horse with his head where his tail should be. Not a word of a lie, ladies. A living creature with his tail where his head should be. See it with your own eyes, and when you tell your menfolk about it, maybe they'll wish they'd stayed with their lovely ladies instead. Oh, yes, my dears, they will indeed.
By now, I'm surrounded. The men have all but disappeared, and I let myself drift along in the current of churchgoers and ladies, of young fellas and the rest of the non-red-blooded Americans. The horse with his tail where his head should be is exactly that. A horse backed into a standing stall so that his tail hangs into his feed bucket.
Oh, for crying out loud, says one woman. Well, I'd never, says another.
But mostly there's relieved laughter, because if this is the horse with the tail where his head should be, then how bad can the men's show be? There is a scuffling outside the tent.
You goddamn sons of bitches! You're damn right I want my money back! You think I'm gonna pay a quarter to see a goddamn pair of suspenders? You talk about red-blooded Americans. Well, this one's red-blooded, all right. I want my goddamn money back.
Excuse me, ma'am, I say, wedging my shoulder between the two women ahead of me.
Hey, mister, what's your hurry?
Excuse me, beg your pardon, I say, pushing my way out. Cecil and a red-faced man are squaring off. The man advances, places both hands on Cecil's chest, and shoves him backward.
The crowd parts, and Cecil crashes against the striped skirt of his platform. The patrons close in behind, standing on tiptoe, gawking. I launch myself through them, reaching Cecil just as the other man hauls off and swings. His fist is but an inch or two from Cecil's chin when I snatch it from the air and twist it behind his back. I lock an arm around his neck and drag him backward. He sputters, reaching up and clawing my forearm. I tighten my grip until my tendons dig into his windpipe and half-drag, half-march him to beyond the end of the midway. Then I chuck him into the dirt. He lies in a cloud of dust, wheezing and grasping his throat. Within seconds, two suited men breeze past me, lift him by the arms and haul him, still coughing, toward the town. They lean into him, pat his back, and mutter encouragement. They straighten his hat, which has miraculously stayed in place. Nice work, says Wade, clapping a hand on my shoulder. You done good, come on back. They'll take care of it from here. Who are they? I say, examining the row of long scratches beaded with blood on my forearm. Patches. They'll calm him down and make him happy. That way we won't catch any heat. He turns to address the crowd, clapping once, loudly, and then rubbing his hands in front of him. Okay, folks, everything's fine, nothing more to see here. The crowd is reluctant to leave. When the man and his escorts finally disappear behind a red brick building, they start to dribble away, but continue to glance hopefully over their shoulders, afraid they'll miss something. Jimmy pushes his way through the stragglers. Hey, he says, Cecil wants to see you. He leads me through to the back end. Cecil sits on the very edge of a folding chair. His legs and spat-clad feet stick straight out. His face is red and moist, and he fans himself with a program. His free hand pats various pockets and then reaches into his vest. He pulls out a flat, square bottle, curls his lips back, and pulls the cork out with his teeth. He spits it off to the side and tips the bottle up. Then he catches sight of me. He stares for a moment, the bottle poised at his lips. He lowers it again, resting it on his rounded belly. He drums his fingers against it, surveying me. You handled yourself pretty well out there, he says finally. Thank you, sir. Where'd you learn that? Dunno. Football? School? Wrangling the odd bull who objected to losing his testicles? He watches me a moment longer. Fingers still drumming, lips pursed. Camel got you on the show yet?
Not officially, no, sir.
There's another long silence. His eyes narrow to slits. Know how to keep your mouth shut. Yes, sir. He takes a long slug from his bottle and relaxes his eyes. Well, okay then, he says, nodding slowly. It's evening, and while the kinkers are delighting the crowd in the big top, I'm standing near the back of a much smaller tent on the far edge of the lot, behind a row of baggage wagons and accessible only through word of mouth and a 50-cent admission fee. The interior is dim, illuminated by a string of red bulbs that casts a warm glow on the woman methodically removing her clothes. My job is to maintain order and periodically smack the sides of the tent with a metal pipe. The better to discourage peeping Toms, or rather, to encourage peeping Toms to come around front and pay their 50 cents. I am also supposed to keep a lid on the kind of behavior I witnessed at the sideshow earlier, although I can't help thinking that the fellow who was so upset this afternoon would find little to complain about here. There are 12 rows of folding chairs, every one of them occupied. Moonshine is passed from man to man, each blindly groping for the bottle because no one wants to take his eyes off the stage. The woman is a statuesque redhead with eyelashes too long to be real and a beauty spot painted next to her full lips. Her legs are long, her hips full, her chest a stupefaction. She is down to a G-string, a glimmering translucent shawl, and a gloriously overflowing brassiere. She shakes her shoulders, keeping gelatinous time with the small band of musicians to her right. She takes a few strides, sliding across the stage in feathered mules. The snare drum rolls, and she stops.
her mouth open in mock surprise. She throws her head back, exposing her throat and sliding her hands down around the cups of her brassiere. She leans forward, squeezing until the flesh swells between her fingers. I scan the sidewalls. A pair of shoe tips peeks under the edge of the canvas. I approach, keeping close to the wall. Just in front of the shoes, I swing the pipe and smack the canvas. There's a grunt, and the shoes disappear. I pause, with my ear to the seam, and then return to my post. The redhead sways with the music, caressing her shawl with lacquered nails. It has gold or silver woven through it and sparkles as she slides it back and forth across her shoulders. She drops forward suddenly at the waist, throws her head back, and shimmies. The men holler. Two or three stand, shaking their fists in encouragement. I glance at Cecil, whose steely gaze tells me to watch them. The woman stands up, turns her back, and strides to the center of the stage. She passes the shawl between her legs, slowly grinding against it. Groans rise from the audience. She spins so she's facing us and continues sliding the shawl back and forth, pulling it so tight the cleft of her vulva shows. Take it off, baby! Take it all off! The men are getting rowdier. More than half are on their feet. Cecil beckons me forward with one hand. I step closer to the rows of folding chairs. The shawl drops to the floor and the woman turns her back once again. She shakes her hair so it ripples over her shoulder blades, and she raises her hands so that they meet at the clasps of her brassiere. A cheer rises from the crowd. She pauses to look over her shoulder and winks, running the straps coquettishly down her arms. Then she drops the bra to the floor and spins around, clutching her breasts in her hands. A howl of protest rises from the men. Oh, come on, sugar, show us what you got! She shakes her head, pouting coyly. Oh, come on, I spent 50 cents! She shakes her head, blinking demurely at the floor. Suddenly her eyes and mouth spring open and she pulls her hands away. Those majestic globes drop. They come to an abrupt stop before swinging gently, even though she's standing perfectly still. There's a collective intake of breath, a moment of awed silence before the men whoop in delight. Yeah, a girl, Lord have mercy, hot damn! She caresses herself, lifting and kneading, rolling her nipples between her fingers. She stares lasciviously down at the men, running her tongue across her upper lip. A drum roll begins. She grasps each hardened point firmly between her thumb and forefinger and pulls one breast so that its nipple points at the ceiling. Its shape changes utterly as the weight redistributes. Then she drops it. It falls suddenly, almost violently. She hangs onto the nipple and lifts the other in the same upward arc. She alternates, picking up speed, lifting, dropping, lifting, dropping. By the time the drum cuts out and the trombone kicks in, her arms move so fast they're a blur, her flesh an undulating, pumping mass. The men holler, screaming their approval. Oh, yeah! Gorgeous, baby, gorgeous! Praise the sweet Lord! Another drum roll begins. She leans forward at the waist, and those glorious tits swing, so heavy, so low, a foot long at least, wider and rounded at the ends, as though each contains a grapefruit. She rolls her shoulders, first one and then the other. Her breasts move in opposite directions. As the speed increases, they swing in ever-widening circles, lengthening as they gain momentum. Before long, they're meeting in the center with an audible slap. Jesus, there could be a riot in the tent, and I wouldn't know it. There's not a drop of blood left in my head. The woman straightens up and then drops into a curtsy. When she stands, she scoops a breast up to her face and slides her tongue around its nipple. Then she slurps it into her mouth. She stands there, shamelessly sucking her own tit as the men wave their hats, pump their fists, and scream like animals. She drops it,
gives the slick nipple a final tweak, and then blows the men a kiss. She leans down long enough to retrieve her diaphanous shawl and disappears. Her arm raised so that the shawl trails behind her, a shimmering banner.
All right then, boys, says Cecil, clapping his hands and climbing the stairs to the stage. Let's have a big hand for our Barbara.
The men cheer and whistle, clapping with hands held high.
Yep, ain't she something? What a lady. And it's your lucky day, boys, because for tonight only, she'll be accepting a limited number of gentlemen callers after the show. This is a real honor, fellas. She's a gem, our Barbara, a real gem.
The men crowd toward the exit, slapping each other on the back, already exchanging memories. Did you see those titties?
Man, what a rack! What I wouldn't give to play with those for a while.
I'm glad nothing requires my intervention, because I'm trying hard to maintain my composure. This is the first time I've ever seen a woman naked, and I don't think I'll ever be the same.
Chapter 4.
I spend the next 45 minutes standing guard outside Barbara's dressing tent as she entertains gentlemen callers. Only 5 are prepared to part with the requisite $2, and they form a surly line. The first goes in, and after 7 minutes of huffing and grunting, emerges again, struggling with his fly. He staggers off, and the next enters. After the last of them leaves, Barbara appears in the doorway. She's nude, except for an oriental silk dressing gown she hasn't bothered to tie. Her hair is mussed, her mouth smudged with lipstick. She holds a burning cigarette in one hand.
That's it, honey, she says, waving me away. There's whiskey on her breath and in her eyes. No freebies tonight.
I return to the cooch tent to stack chairs and help dismantle the stage while Cecil counts the money. At the end of it, I'm a dollar richer and stiff all over. The big top still stands, glowing like a ghostly coliseum and pulsing with the sound of the band. I stare at it, entranced by the sound of the audience's reactions. They laugh, clap, and whistle. Sometimes there's a collective intake of breath or patter of nervous shrieks. I check my pocket watch. It's 9:45. I consider trying to catch part of the show, but I'm afraid that if I cross the lot, I'll get shanghaied into some other task. The roustabouts, having spent much of the day sleeping in whatever corner they could find, are dismantling the great canvas city as efficiently as they put it up. Tents drop to the ground and poles topple. Horses, wagons, and men trek across the lot, hauling everything back to the side rail. I sink to the ground and rest my head on Ray's knees.
Jacob, is that you?
I look up. Camo limps over, squinting.
By gum, I thought it was, he says. The old peepers ain't working so good no more.
He eases himself down next to me and pulls out a small green bottle. He picks the cork out and takes a drink.
I'm getting too old for this, Jacob. I ache all over at the end of every day. Hell, I ache all over now, and we ain't even at the end of the day yet. The flying squadron won't pull out for probably 2 more hours, and we start the whole dang thing over again 5 hours after that. It's no life for an old man.
He passes me the bottle. What the hell is this? I say, staring at the brackish liquid.
It's Jake,
he says, snatching it back. You're drinking extract?
Yeah, so?
We sit in silence for a minute.
Damn prohibition,
Camel finally says.
This stuff used to taste just fine till the government decided it shouldn't. Still gets the job done, but tastes like hell. And it's a damn shame because it's all that keeps these old bones going anymore. I'm about used up. Ain't good for nothing but ticket seller. And I reckon I'm too ugly for that.
I glance over and decide he's right. Is there something else you can do instead? Maybe behind the scenes?
Ticket seller's the last stop.
What'll you do when you can't manage anymore?
I reckon I'll have an appointment with Blackie. Hey,
he says, turning to me hopefully.
Got any cigarettes?
No, sorry.
I didn't suppose.
He sighs. We sit in silence, watching team after team haul equipment, animals, and canvas back to the train. Performers leaving the back end of the big top disappear into dressing tents and emerge in street clothes. They stand in groups, laughing and talking, some still wiping their faces. Even out of costume, they're glamorous. The drab workmen scuttle all around, occupying the same universe, but seemingly on a different dimension. There is no interaction. Camel interrupts my reverie.
You a college boy?
Yes, sir.
I figured you for one.
He offers the bottle again, but I shake my head.
Did you finish?
No, I say.
Why not?
I don't answer.
How old are you, Jacob?
23.
I got a boy your age.
The music has ended. Townspeople start to trickle from the big top. They stop, perplexed, wondering what happened to the menagerie through which they entered. As they leave by the front, an army of men enter by the back and return, carting bleachers, seats, and ring curbs, which they fling noisily into lumber wagons. The big top is being gutted before the audience has even left it. Camel coughs wetly, the effort racking his body. I look to see if he needs a thump on the back, but he's holding up a hand to stop me. He snorts, hawks, and then spits. Then he drains the bottle. He wipes his mouth with the back of his hand and looks over at me, eyeing me from head to toe.
Listen,
he says.
I ain't trying to know your business, but I do know you ain't been on the road long. You're too clean, your clothes are too good, and you don't got a possession in the world. You collect things on the road. Maybe not nice things, but you collect them all the same. I know I ain't got no talking room, but a boy like you shouldn't be on the bum. I've been on the bum, and it ain't no life.
His forearms rest on his raised knees, his face turned to mine.
If you got a life to go back to, I reckon that's what you should do.
It's a moment before I can answer. When I do, my voice cracks. I don't. He watches me for a while longer and then nods.
I'm right sorry to hear that.
The crowd disperses, moving from the big top to the parking lot and beyond, to the edges of the town. From behind the big top, the silhouette of a balloon rises into the sky, followed by a child's prolonged wail. There's laughter, the sound of car engines, voices raised in excitement.
Can you believe she bent like that? I thought I was gonna die when the clown dropped his drawers.
Where's Jimmy? Hank, have you got Jimmy?
Camel scrambles suddenly to his feet.
Oh, there he is. There's that old SOB now.
Who?
Uncle Al. Come on, we gotta get you on the show.
He limps off faster than I would have thought possible. I get up and follow. There is no mistaking Uncle Al. He has Ringmaster written all over him, from the scarlet coat and white jodhpurs to the top hat and waxed curled mustache. He strides across the lot like the leader of a marching band, ample belly thrust forward and issuing orders in a booming voice. He pauses to let a lion's den cross in front of him and then continues past a group of men struggling with a rolled canvas. Without breaking stride, he smacks one of them on the side of the head. The man yelps and turns, rubbing his ear, but Uncle Al's gone, trailed by followers.
That reminds me,
Camel says over his shoulder.
Whatever you do, don't mention Ringling in front of Uncle Al.
Why not?
Just don't.
Camel scurries up to Uncle Al and steps into his path.
Oh, there you are,
he says, his voice artificial and mewling.
I was wondering if I could have a word, sir.
Not now, boy, not now,
booms Al, goose-stepping past like the brown shirts you see in the grainy news trailers at the movies.
Camel limps weakly behind, popping his head around one side, and then falling back and running along the other like a disgraced puppy.
It won't take but a moment, sir. It's just I was wondering if any of the departments was short of men.
Thinking of changing careers, are we?
Camel's voice rises like a siren.
Oh, no, sir, not me. I'm happy right where I am. Yes, sir, happy as a clam. That's me.
He giggles maniacally. The distance between them widens. Camel stumbles and then comes to a stop.
Sir,
he calls across the growing distance. He comes to a stop.
Sir,
Uncle Al is gone, swallowed whole by people, horses, and wagons.
God damn it, God damn it,
says Camel, tearing his hat from his head and throwing it to the ground. It's okay, Camel, I say. I appreciate you trying.
No, it ain't okay,
he shouts. Camel, I...
Just shut it! I don't want to hear it. You're a good kid, and I ain't about to stand by and watch you mope off because that fat old grouch don't got time. I just ain't. So have a little respect for your elders and don't give me no trouble.
His eyes are burning. I lean over, retrieve his hat, and brush the dirt off. Then I hold it out to him. After a moment, he takes it.
All right, then,
he says gruffly.
I guess that's all right.
Camel takes me to a wagon and tells me to wait outside. I lean against one of the large spoked wheels and pass the time alternately picking slivers from beneath my nails and chewing long pieces of grass. At one point, my head bobs forward on the cusp of sleep. Camel emerges an hour later, staggering, holding a flask in one hand and a roll-your-own in the other. His eyelids flutter at half-mast.
It's here's Earl,
he slurs, sweeping an arm behind him.
He's gonna take care of you.
A bald man steps down from the wagon. He's enormous, his neck thicker than his head. Blurred green tattoos run across his knuckles and up his hairy arms. He holds out his hand.
How do you do?
He says. How do you do? I say, perplexed. I swing around to Camel, who's zigzagging through the crispy grass in the general direction of the flying squadron. He's also singing, badly. Earl cups his hands around his mouth.
Shut it, Camel. Get yourself on that train before it leaves without you.
Camel drops to his knees.
Ah, Jesus, says Earl. Hang on, I'll be back in a minute.
He walks over and scoops the older man off the ground as easily as if he were a child. Camel lets his arms, legs, and head dangle over Earl's arms. He giggles and sighs. Earl sets Camel on the edge of a car's doorway, consults with someone inside, and then returns.
Stuff's gonna kill the old feller,
he mutters, marching straight past me.
If he don't rot out his guts, he'll roll off the goddamn train. Don't touch the stuff myself,
he says, looking over his shoulder at me. I'm rooted to the spot where he left me. He looks surprised.
You coming or what?
When the final section of the train pulls out, I'm crouched under a bunk in a sleeping car wedged against another man. He's the rightful owner of the space, but he was persuaded to let me hang out for an hour or two for a price of my $1. He grumbles anyway, and I hug my knees to make myself as compact as possible. The odor of unwashed bodies and clothes is overwhelming. The bunks stacked three high hold at least one and sometimes two men, as do the spaces beneath them. The fellow wedged in the floor space across from me punches a thin gray blanket, trying in vain to form a pillow. A voice carries across the jumble of noise.
Oče náš, któryś jest w niebie, święć się imię Twoje, przyjdź królestwo Twoje.
Jesus Christ, my host says. He pokes his head into the aisle. Speak English, you fucking Polack! Then he retreats back under the bunk, shaking his head. Some of these guys right off the fucking boat.
I nie wódź nas na pokuszenie, ale nas baw odezwelgo. Amen.
I nestle against the wall and close my eyes. Amen, I whisper. The train lurches. The lights flicker for a moment and go out. From somewhere ahead of us, a whistle screeches. We begin rolling forward and the lights come back on. I'm tired beyond words and my head bumps unbuffered against the wall. I wake sometime later and find myself facing a pair of huge work boots. You ready then? I shake my head, trying